Our world is lost in unnecessary fear and hurt. Our systems seem scientifically engineered to make you small, powerless, and always waiting for the next great leader who will fix the problems around us. Worse, we're witnessing neighbor versus neighbor while warfare breaks out around our family tables. But you have access to a spirit, a strength that enlarges and empowers you. Even better, you don't need to wait for the next big movement. You can heal the world. It's time for governance by grace. Welcome to Gracearchy with Jim Babka. So we had this amazing thing happen here on Gracearchy, brought to you by the Zero Aggression Project, zeroaggressionproject.org. And Jim and I have been scratching our heads trying to figure out how to make this work. So I'm going to just turn it over to you, Jim.
Well, we're doing something a little backwards. So
yeah,
everybody's already had a chance to see the Jerry Boyer interview where we cover the maker versus the takers, a book that demonstrates that Jesus was, at minimum, not a socialist. And we encourage people to check that out. We're not trying to use politics to our advantage or, you know, whatever. You should check it out.
Yeah, it's a good book. Read it, people. It's really a good book.
But we got into a personal conversation because he and I also relate on a level of interest in Rene Girard. And he has had a very interesting, famous media career. Like, he's been at the top levels of things and exposed to things on a major network. And so that opened a door. And it is rare that I am sitting here in this chair and something happens that's so surprising and enlightening to me. And we felt that instead of cramming that into the other interview and people missing it, because we know that people, there's kind of a time limit to how much they want to watch anyway. We were afraid we believe this needed to be its own episode all by itself, because yep, the insight that Jerry ends up laying on about Jesus, one of Jesus' parables, was so eye-opening. You'll understand why that's important in a moment. So eye-opening to me. I was moved. I found it's profound. I will not look at this parable in exactly the same way again. I will see it differently. So I encourage you to stay tuned for this rather serendipitous episode of Gracearchy.
Nice job with all the double entendres there, man. Here we go.
Yes. So, Jerry, I want to kind of get started with who you are. And let me tell you my story. I had this odd window of time from like 2006, late 2006, maybe even until 2010, where I was starting to watch a lot of CNBC and part of my nightly mix. And you were a regular guest on my favorite show at the time on that station, which was Larry Kudlow's show. And so fast forward, we share a mutual interest in Rene Girard, whom we've talked about in the show. We won't have a lot of time to get into that today. But I read a eulogy, a memorial editorial that you wrote that I was very significant. And I went, holy cow. I mean, that's Jerry Boyer as seen on TV, right? I know who that guy is. And I was thrilled that you were a Girardian. And I went looking for you on Facebook and we became Facebook friends. Like, I hunted you down. I'm like, I got to know Jerry. I'm like, this is amazing to me that this guy is both like awesome when he was on CNBC, but even more importantly, because I think we've both grown up some since then, that you're a Girardian. So that was my initial exposure to you.
Well, that's very nice. And those things sort of tie together in that those were the years that helped me internalize the degree to which media is driven by mimetic rivalry and conflict. And, you know, when I was initially brought on some of these shows, it was, I'd been brought on CNN, FN, when there was such a thing, and then CNBC, and later on Fox News and Fox Business News. What I learned pretty quickly is that what got the interest of producers and what got the interest of the audience was conflict. And I think the reason that CNBC ended up making an offer to me to be on contract there, to be a regular, was because up until then, there wasn't really a lot of conflict on financial television. you know, was basically tin prices went up, blah, 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 you know, American paper went down. That, you know, it was very sort of dull and, you know, flows of price data, you know, maybe some stuff about annual meetings. And then as our country became more polarized, the polarization spilled out into financial television, especially in and around the Great Recession and the bailout that came after. And I have a combative personality. And so what happened is I would go on CNBC and I would debate people. And all of a sudden ratings would spike. And so would blood pressure. And so would adrenaline. But ratings would spike. And eventually they created this little graphic when I was on with people, these two, coming together. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. And they would blow up as soon as they hit. Yep.
I didn't even know that they had done that. So I would start to debate with someone about bull versus bear or bailout versus not or capitalism versus socialism. And those would appear. And I understood that I had fallen into or been pulled into or lapsed into and then got recruited into more of the role of being a gladiator. And that was really informative to me. The other thing that was informative to me was how much competition there was to be on TV. Even though being on TV is not a highly productive thing to do, you don't get paid much. And even if you're an asset manager or you're selling a newsletter or something like that, I would talk to people in the green room and they weren't really getting any business out of it. You know, they'd go on TV and it'd be so-and-so from such-and-such capital. So they'd be asset managers, but they'd go on TV and they'd have to prep. That would take their whole day. They'd drive, they'd put on a suit and they'd drive downtown, or maybe they're already out on a suit because they're asset managers. They'd put on the tie, they'd drive downtown, they'd wait for an hour in the chair, they would do 5 minutes, then they would, you know, have rush hour going back, and then they'd go back and there wouldn't be any new customers in their email, in their voicemail. There might be people saying, "Hey, saw you on TV, that was great." But they would be friends or other people in the industry. They weren't customers. So they weren't making money. They were just being on TV. And that really, so why did they want to be on TV? Mm-hmm. And none of them could really answer that, except the answer that I started to hear was, well, it must be valuable because other people want to be on TV. And I thought, true. Why do I think it's valuable to be on TV? I would get $500 to be on TV, which is not a huge amount of money. Right? Because it's a lost day, right? And if you're in finance, you're not making $500. You're probably doing better than $500 a day. So, why are you doing it? Well, it must be important. It must be valuable because other people are doing it. And I'd been reading a little bit of Girard, and I was reading more Girard, and then it's like, oh, I get it now. I understand. I remember later, this was after I'd left CNBC, I was on Fox Business News some, and they had scheduled me to talk about a topic, you know, like the day before. It was like Monday. Hey, let's have you on tomorrow. We're going to talk. We want to talk about a topic. What's the topic? The topic is, you know, the decline in the dollar. Oh, okay, great. You know, a monetary economist. I'd love to talk about that. And then Tuesday morning, they say, hey, we've got you scheduled for noon today, but we changed the topic. Well, what's the topic changed to? Well, they found this lizard in Texas, and it's an endangered species, so they're not going to build an oil well. And I said, well, I'm not prepped for that. I don't have any lizard expertise. It's not my area. Lizardology is not my area. It's hepatology? I don't know. It's not my area. So shouldn't we discuss this? Well, just say this. Well, I'm not really sure I want to change topic. There's 10 people waiting behind you in line. Okay, go to the other 10 then. And I realized they were able to do that the people on TV had essentially become commoditized because so many people wanted to do it. And again, it was conflict-oriented. You had producers who would create a conflict script and essentially hand you the conflict script. So at that point, I pretty much had my fill and got out of that. And the other thing I noticed is the people who were on TV the most, when I was on TV a lot, I was studying less. I was researching data less. I was reading fewer books. I was reading fewer articles. So the more I was on television, the less I knew. So think about that from the consumer side.
Yes, yes.
The people who are on TV the most are probably know less because they're on TV so much. So you have a lower and lower quality of information. And we've all sort of noticed that, haven't we? There's almost no, what George Gilder would call entropy. Entropy or signal. There's almost no signal that comes through cable television. It's really conflict over already established facts. So we know that there was a State of the Union speech and we know what was said. So there's not really news. There's fighting over news. There's not actually a lot of new information coming across. And so I think it's addictive for the people who are on TV.
Oh, yes.
And I think it's addictive for the people who are watching it. I know friends, they just had to watch Tucker every night. And didn't matter what he was saying was true. It was conflict. He was sticking it to them. He might have switched up. He might have totally switched his position from 2 weeks ago. And now he's before it's like they're not doing enough about COVID. They don't care about you. They need to take COVID seriously. And then a month later, it's they're doing too much about COVID. They're taking away your freedoms. They're scaring you.
Yes.
Everyone just pivoted along with him, forgetting, you know, that they were mad before because there weren't shutdowns, and now they're mad because there are.
No, they need that. They need that anger stimulator, that adrenaline drive, the ego, the tribalism. They need all that stuff to happen. So, you know, Bill reads an article that I write for a now defunct project and contacts me and says, can you come on a podcast that I'm involved with called Authentic Human Outliers? And on that podcast, one of the clips that you've made from it, it's still available on the tube of you, is me talking about a media fast and the discovery of like the ability to turn the television off and not watch any of that stuff for a while. And you don't see it the same way when you come back to it after you've been off for a while. It's kind of like if you quit drinking Diet Coke, it tastes way different when you resume drinking it. You know, it turns out that there's something kind of an acquired taste. It's stimulating something in you. If you cut those empty calories out, you find that you can live happier without them.
Yeah. Well, I think in both cases, there's a certain dopamine addiction. One of the things that we did before we cut TV, and we have cut it, is we had a TV in the kitchen where we go for coffee, and I drink a lot of coffee. So that's my more acceptable dopamine addiction. And what I had a little habit that I went back and forth that sometimes it was on, if it was on Fox, I would, you know, as I'm pouring the coffee, I'd hear what they're saying. And then before I left, I'd flip over to MSNBC or CNN. So flipping back and forth, it's a little bit like, what's that therapy they do for trauma? You go back and forth between. So flipping back and forth between them was fascinating to see a couple of things. Mm-hmm. One, here's the really important thing, how similar they were, right? And one of the things I noticed is not only are they similar in the level of outrage and the way they're basically plucking our limbic system. They're playing a little tune on our limbic system. They're engaging the lizard brain. But the other thing I noticed was how much time they're spending playing footage of the other one. So So Tucker, I pick on Tucker because he's probably better at it than anybody else. And I don't mean that as a compliment. So Tucker would play long clips from his rival, might be Don Lemon, right, over at CNN. And Don Lemon or Andrew Cuomo, which is that the Cuomo? I can't even remember. One of the Cuomos would play long clips from Tucker or from later on, some, you know, the Five or something like that. So they were so fascinated with one another that they were mostly talking about one another. Gerard says that fascination is a strong sign of mimetic entanglement and rivalry. So they were, so, and here's how kind of intricate and weirdly twisted it gets. Tucker is playing footage of someone from CNN talking about Tucker. Fox News is playing CNN footage of people talking about Fox News. And CNN is playing footage of people on Fox talking about CNN. Is that not an amazing thing?
There's one other thing just like that that goes on. MSNBC and CNN have the same top three stories most shows.
Yeah.
Right. So if you flip, I can't say that's always one for one at the same time, but if you click back and forth like 1-2, you'll find that they're covering the same things with much the same verbiage. Fox has a different thing that they're usually doing right now.
Right.
That wasn't necessarily true 5-7 years ago, but right now it is.
Yes.
They're programming their audience in a different way, and it is them programming their audience.
Yeah, it's amazing how much they were covering each other's coverage of one another. And I'm reminded, so this is a little complicated, but let's try it. In Matthew 7, Jesus tells a kind of a little mini parable, which is about somebody who is trying to take a speck out of somebody else's eye. Right. And we kind of treat that as essentially don't be a hypocrite. You know, people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, or, you know, the pot calling the kettle black, et cetera. And I think they're missing the incredible complexity and wisdom and power of Jesus's analogy. Because if I'm, so let's think of it this way. I'm leaning in here because this is I stuff. Okay. So, so Jesus is talking about looking to fix somebody's eye. Now, if Jesus is talking about me trying to fix a flaw in you, there could be many flaws. You could be you could be a hunchback, right? You could have a cleft palate. Maybe your leg doesn't work properly, a splinter in your foot or something like that. And I'm trying to fix that. So why does Jesus talk about specifically the eye? The eye is the organ of perception. In the Bible, going back to Vayara Elohim Kitov, God saw that it was good, right? In the creation account, over and over again, God looks and he evaluates. So in the Bible, the eye is the evaluative organ, right? So if I think that there's something wrong with your eye, what am I really bothered by?
My perception.
Yes.
I'm not seeing the picture in the right way, and you need to set me straight.
Exactly. Okay, so let's narrow in a little more. If I'm leaning into you to fix your eye, so here I am leaning into the camera. They say, don't do this in podcasts, that it freaks people out. But it's part of the message. So if I'm leaning in to you to pluck something out of your eye, I think you're not perceiving something correctly. What are you perceiving right now as I'm leaning into you?
Well, that you're invading my space.
Well, yeah. So you're perceiving me. See, I mean, if I'm in there close, what are you seeing? You're seeing me.
Yeah.
Okay. So I don't like the way you see the world. Let's narrow it down. I don't like the way you see me. Okay. So if I'm trying to pluck a mote out of your eye, I'm trying to fix the way you literally, I'm trying to fix the way you look at me. What bothers
Interesting.
Me, you see it?
Yes, I do.
So I'm trying to fix your perception. I'm trying to fix your perception of me, right? So if you look really closely into an eye, if I'm looking in your eye closely, what am I seeing? Well, eyes are literally mirrors. I mean, that's the back of the eye is a mirror. I'm seeing you seeing me. I'm seeing a little reflection of myself in you, in your eye. And if you've got a speck or a mote, what do I see? I see a distorted perspective of myself. You see what I'm saying? If I reach into you and you've got a speck in your eye, that means I'm trying to fix the way you see me. You are seeing me in a distortive way. And I can see the distortive image of myself in your eye. So I don't like the way you look at me because you see me in a distortive way, right? You are magnifying my flaws, right? That's the plank.
And we all want to be
of your flaw of your flawed view of me.
And we all want to be understood, right? So if somebody doesn't see us or understand us in the right way, we take offense to it.
Right. And so I think you see in a lot of emetic conflict. I was just in a debate with somebody. It hasn't been published yet, but maybe it will, where basically we were debating about ideas. And I rebutted this person's ideas about economics. And he wrote an angry email saying, "You called me an ignoramus." But I didn't call him an ignoramus. I just rebutted factual errors. But what he saw was that I think he's an ignoramus. See, for him, it was about how do I see him? I wasn't thinking about how I saw him at all. I was thinking about, you know, he was blaming the free market in this particular case for the Great Recession. And I'm saying, no, that's not what happened. The government pressured these banks to lower credit quality standards, et cetera. It exposed a certain ignorance, but I never said you're ignorant, right? Mm-hmm. But he felt ignorant. So in conflict, often this happens with spouses or in any situation. You say, I'm not sure I agree. I don't think that's correct. Oh, you think I'm stupid. Well, right. I didn't say anything about
right.
But when we have conflict, what we're mostly getting is we think that someone is seeing us as inferior. And that's one of the things that makes mimetic rivalry so powerful. And that's what I think what makes Jesus' analogy so incredibly powerful.
No, you've taken us to a whole depth level on this.
Exactly. So if I'm obsessed with your view of me, I can't help you and I can't help me. If I have to get into your face, to look into your eye, to say, you're not seeing me the right way, and I can't let that go. I can't break away. You're seeing me the wrong way, Don Lemon. You're seeing me the wrong way, Tucker Carlson. You're seeing me the wrong way, conservative Trump uncle. You're seeing me the wrong way, young woman, millennial, also at Thanksgiving dinner. You think I'm an idiot. You think I'm a bigot. You think this. And they don't think those things. They just differ on opinion. If I'm obsessed with how you see me, we're not going to get anywhere. So I have to just detach. Really, if I'm going to take the speck out of my eye, I'm not looking at you at all. If I have to take the speck out of my eye, what am I looking at?
Probably a mirror.
Bingo. If I have to stop looking at you and I have to start looking at a mirror. And then maybe I can help you.
Well, isn't our big problem today that we're so immune to looking at mirrors and so addicted to projecting what about ourselves is not really true?
We got screens in front of us all the time. There's screens everywhere. They're ubiquitous. You go into bars, you go into the airport. Everywhere you go, there's screens. We're holding them in our hands.
All those screens are, to some degree, us trying to take the mote out of somebody's eyes. All of those screens are about outrage about the other side, or almost all of those screens. Increasingly, it used to be what they call upvote, but that was really the way to go viral. You know, like a dad coming home from military service and his daughter's in kindergarten and, oh, daddy, I missed you. And that's so great. Or there'd be a flash mob and they would do Beethoven's, you know, Ode to Joy. And we would forward that. How much are people forwarding that stuff anyway? It's all some terrible thing that somebody said about us. Right. So those screens aren't mirrors. They're just electronically augmented ways of making us obsessed with the mote in somebody else's eye, making us obsessed with how they see us. And mirrors are powerful. And that's why Jesus's brother, maybe disciple, maybe brother, James, writes a letter, which is all about mimetic conflict. It's all about the war, the tongue is a fire, be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. Why are there wars amongst you? It's the letter that James writes. He's the bishop of Jerusalem or the overseer of Jerusalem. And he talks about mirrors. He says that you have to look in the mirror, the royal law of Jesus. What is that? Well, you're looking at the mirror and you're saying, how much does that look like Jesus? I'm looking at me in the mirror and I'm saying, how much am I like Jesus? And the answer is not very much. So I'm not obsessed with you anymore. I am looking at myself. And screens are not only not mirrors. Screens are the opposite of mirrors. Screens help us avoid mirrors. Screens help us not know who we are.
Wow.
Yeah, they keep the glass dark.
They do.
Okay. Let me try this at one other level. I want to throw something at you because I love where you're going here. And maybe you don't have an answer for this. And maybe you do. If you don't, we can just move on. But Is it possible that another reason that Jesus is telling this from, you've got me, my brain moving right now, that he's, another reason he might be doing this is because when we consider eyes to be windows of the soul. Mm-hmm. In other words, like we're like looking, we're into someone else's eye profoundly, deeply to find out something. I'm struck, and I think you've given a really plausible explanation here, but I don't know if it's a complete one, how obsessed we are with the opinions of others, even when perhaps we don't think they're about us specifically, right? Like everyone needs to agree with me. And that's yes. become more and more true. And I'm wondering why that's so important. I'm wondering why somebody could say something even about somebody else. It's not about me. And it has nothing to do with me. And yet I could go off. I feel some anger inside myself that they have such a wrong opinion.
Yeah.
For example, if you ever encountered somebody, I try to assiduously to avoid this. I've changed my mind about a lot of things in my life, Jerry, but I don't want to be that guy who, having just figured something out, turns around and says to everybody else, "You're stupid." Right. And you've met this person that becomes suddenly the fundamentalist zealot. Right. After the moment of their conversion, they've just discovered something. They've just got on the boat.
Right.
But and they're looking at everybody isn't yet on the boat, and they're angry and upset with them. Like, is the eye, is another reason that that's there, is that it's a window to the soul. And is that relevant to any of the things that we're discussing here? Is it expansive of it?
Yes. I think if you take a Girardian view, you know, the souls are like feeding eat into one another. They're interdependent. Right. So we don't get to look at someone's soul except to the degree or about how that person relates to us. So I think that when we're angry about an opinion that someone has that we disagree with, that means that at some level, their opinion is about us. No, I'm saying it wrong. Their opinion feels like it's about us. So if somebody is really wrong about something, then that means they're extremely different from me. That's cognitive dissonance. So why is cognitive dissonance anger-inducing rather than just bewildering? You know, you look at calculus, you don't get angry. It's just like, it's hard, right? And yet when someone sees something from a different point of view, you know, it makes you angry. Because
what if we lost here? I mean, what's the missing piece, you know?
Yeah. I think the added piece is that we need them to affirm us if they see the world so differently that we see it as implicitly an attack on us. If you're right, I've got to be evil.
Yes, yeah.
I've got to be an idiot.
Or implicitly
an idiot, so you must be an evil idiot.
Or implicitly an attack on our team. Because it's interesting how much people are willing to sacrifice. So this is another phenomenon we have discussed as part of the byproduct of the conflict machine is that people enter politics, to pick up a scenario, completely committed to some principle or idea. They sign up for the team, right? And I really care about the X idea. But over time, the need to win takes over, and you're part of a team of people who ostensibly share your values, and it becomes more important that your team wins. And then this gives way to yet one more phenomenon. So I'm down. I've told this story several times. The audience will be familiar with it. But Jerry, I'm down in Florida in 2018, circa timeframe, maybe 19. And I travel up through Georgia. And during this trip, it was a donor trip, I met with three different men. And bizarrely, they all had read the same book. They had read the Dilbert creator's book, Scott Adams. They had read his book.
Yes.
And they all told me some variation from strong to weak of, well, you know, at the end of the day, the thing I enjoy the most about Donald Trump is he makes liberals cry.
Yes.
So they had gone from an issue to a team winning to, I don't care about any of this anymore. I just want to see the enemy. Yes.
Right. The ultimate fulfillment is in making the other team lose. So, I mean, he's part of my own, the ecosystem with Salem Media, but I'm thinking about Dennis Prager, who said that the greatest day of his life was when Donald Trump won the presidency. And he said,
free material.
What's that?
Free material.
Yeah, exactly. So he said, and I'm including the birth of my sons and my marriage. It's like, okay. When you go home tonight, Dennis, you're going to have some explaining to do. So why? Because look at the way the liberals reacted. look at what it did to them. It gave them a comeuppance. I mean, think about how mimetically, you know, rivalrously, you have to be where at the end, it's just from hell's heart, I stab at thee. I lost, but you lost too. If I can make you lose more, that's the only win for me. So I think that's a more advanced stage of the addiction of conflict and what you call the conflict machine. You know, that's the conflict machine kind of whirring at its most effective. It feeds on that. Hey, do you remember that Star Trek episode, the original series, where there was this like red, like monster, this red spinning light, and it would make everyone hate one another and they would fight. And it fed on the hate, right? Its food was hate. I think that the later on in the extended universe, its name is Asterisk. It doesn't even have a name because it doesn't have to have a name. It's a nothingness, but it feeds on hate. And you know, Sulu would stab someone and then it would resurrect them so they could keep fighting forever. That's the conflict machine. It's that, but that's what Gerard would call the Satan, right? The accuser. It is a social phenomenon. Now you can get into theologically, you know, what's going on there, but we can see it from a social science standpoint. It is a social mechanism that feeds on our conflict and encourages that conflict. And it's terrible. And that's where you get, you know, I like Donald Trump because he makes liberals cry. I mean, people were selling little Chotskys. Conservatives were selling Chotskys of cups of liberal tears.
Yes.
You seen those?
Yes.
Now
you're going almost Baudrillard there, right? This is starting to get into Matrix territory where we've got the imitation of the thing. It's no longer even, it's an artificial version of the real thing. It's just.
Yes. Yeah. And we're going to sacramentally drink the tears.
Oh God.
We're going to sacramentally drink the pain. Whereas Gerard says in the real Eucharist, we're sacramentally acknowledging that basically left to ourselves, we're cannibals. I mean, that's what Gerard says about the Eucharist. What an amazing religious ritual. The religious ritual is, if you leave us to ourselves, we're going to try to kill God. We're going to kill the most innocent person, the only innocent person who ever lived. That's where we are. So we're the pain creators. And so we're sacramental. We're drinking our coffee. We're calling it liberal tears because their pain is drink to us. It literally quenches our thirst. That's not the conservatism I signed up for.
Yeah, this is so. I got to tell you, this conversation has been amazing, completely unplanned, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very moved, and I've already learned something. So, you know, we could almost like turn off the mics and the cameras and go away now.